This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. We've got a double issue of the magazine as we head into the Labor Day holiday. And Tim, the unofficial official start to fall. It's getting cooler in the city.
It's getting cooler. Still feels like a little bit summer weather.
Yes.
I'm not ready to get the pumpkin spice lattes and the sweaters out quite yet.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay.
I do love fall, though.
I do, too.
But can't say goodbye to summer.
No, I agree with you.
Well, we got a great program coming up. Bloomberg's Mark Bergen is joining us on YouTube's content moderation policy and why the company has struggled to crack down on white extremism. It's all in his new book. It's called Like, Comment, Subscribe: Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination.
And yes, of course, the countdown to the next Fed meeting, it is on. But investors and corporate leaders are still sorting through Fed Chairman Jay Powell's hawkish message at Jackson Hole. Weighing in on that with his front row seat on global supply chains, we checked in with Paul Lundstrom, CFO of global manufacturing company Flex.
And later on, women's ongoing struggle for equality. Fitting timing, too, as August 26th marked the 102nd anniversary of the certification of the 19th Amendment. That was passed back in 1920.
All right. Full equality, folks. I'm just going to say we're still waiting.
Yeah, we are. It's been more than 100 years.
Yep. All of that to come. We begin with this week's remarks in the magazine, which also happened to be the issue's cover story. President Biden recently announced a sweeping package of student debt relief. You know that, for giving as much as $20,000 in loans for some recipients.
Bloomberg Opinion editor Ramesh Ratnazar says that the bailout doesn't address the fundamental problem. Too many college students are getting a bad return on their investments. We spoke to Ramesh for his take on what Biden got wrong.
I don't want to understate, the impact that loan forgiveness is going to have for, a lot of Americans, particularly, the people who, were on Pell Grants, received Pell Grants. So these are low, middle income students. Who are in many cases going to see their debts completely wiped out. That's life-changing for a lot of them. But, the underlying issue remains, which is we have a system in which, in order to have a good-paying career, people feel they need to go to college, whether that's 2 years or 4 years. And for an increasing number of those people, the gains of going to college just don't match the costs of doing so. And that's what's putting them in a position where they are leaving with debt that they can't repay. That's what's caused this bigger crisis. So forgiving debts, it's going to help some people. It doesn't really solve the problem.
How did we get here? Because schools say, well, wait a minute, we've got to attract teachers. We've got to attract facilities. I want my daughter to learn. I don't really care if it's the newest gym that she's playing in.
There are a lot of factors. Certainly, there's been underinvestment in public institutions, really beginning with the Great Recession. The bargain has flipped, whereas government for a long time basically picked up most of the tab of the cost of college. Now that's been basically flipped over to families. The student loan system exacerbates the problem because basically it provides a subsidy to institutions and removes any incentive for them to lower tuition so that people can afford it, because you can just take out federal student loans that the federal government covers, and institutions, colleges don't really have no skin in the game. And what we have seen, yes, that in order to attract students, they have invested a lot of money in, you know, improving the student experience and amenities, facilities, not necessarily instruction and research. And that's all contributed to driving up these costs to the levels that we're seeing.
What's the justification for tuition costs and college costs, you know, outpacing inflation by a mile?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, outpacing virtually every other service in our economy. You know, I think one thing that's important to point out is that for students who attend the most selective colleges, colleges that accept less than 50% of applicants, but it's a very small percentage of the overall student population, the return on investment over your lifetime is still pretty good. It's still probably going to be worth your while if you get a degree from one of those institutions. The problem is that's not where most people are going to school. And what you have is the vast majority of Americans who are going to colleges in programs that just are not delivering that return. And even worse, a third of people who enroll in college never get their degree to begin with. And it's really that cohort that is sort of at the heart of the crisis of student loan debt.
Well, Ramesh, what I really like about your piece is that it ends on, you know, I don't necessarily want to say optimistic because there's a lot that has to get done for this to improve, but the word you use is aspirational. And let's say that members of Congress got along with one another and that everyone was on the same page when it came to higher education. If you could wave a magic wand and fix this, what would that look like? What's that aspirational element that you write about?
I think the big thing that needs to happen is there needs to be more innovation in the system. Consumers need more choices. The old traditional model is just not working for enough students. And so, you know, we are way behind other countries when it comes to apprenticeships, you know, work-based training programs, the kinds of things that give people an alternative to having to go to four-year universities, try to get a bachelor's degree of unclear value. We need more post-secondary programs that are really geared toward giving people skills that they can take to the marketplace.
That was Bloomberg Opinion editor Ramesh Ratnazar with this week's cover story. You can read the full issue online on the Bloomberg Terminal and out on newsstands now.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
China continues to amp up its stimulus measures to help out its slowing economy. You might recall just over a week ago, China amping up that stimulus by another 1 trillion yuan or $146 billion U.S., funding largely focused once again, Tim, on infrastructure spending.
That support, though, likely won't go far enough to counter the damage from repeated COVID lockdowns and a property market slump.
Yeah, I just can't get ahead of that. To help us make sense of the situation, Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney and I spoke with David Riedel, president and founder of Riedel Research Group. We started by asking what China's stimulus can do, especially if the country keeps opening and closing. We keep seeing the pressure caused by COVID.
Yeah, that's a real concern. I think people have been a little bit naive, ignoring some of the big issues, that headwinds that China's facing these days. You talked about regulatory oversight. We, of course, in the last couple of years had big crackdowns on big tech and data integrity and things in China, which had a big negative impact on some of the ADRs. We've heard about COVID, the zero policy, really being a hamstringing the economy. Of course, the property market overhang. The one thing I think people are really ignoring is a historic drought taking place in China. Mm-hmm. Food security is a big, big deal to Beijing, and this drought is a real threat.
I have to say, we actually talked about it yesterday on air and talking about the Three Gorges Dam,
right,
and just what's happening in terms of the importance of water when it comes to powering facilities throughout China. Talk to us a little bit more about what you're hearing. I'm curious, I don't know whether you've been traveling back and forth yet from Asia. I know you often do, but tell us what you're hearing about this and its impact on China specifically.
Yeah, I haven't been to China itself in a while. I've been nearby, but not in China for some time. But we have people on the ground there, and they're saying it's just unprecedented seeing how small the Yangtze River is. We're hearing a lot about the Rhine and the dramatic weather in, yep, in Europe. We're just not hearing it as much about China. And it's a big deal. I mean, 20% of their power comes from hydropower. That's really under threat. If they have to replace that, they have to replace it with coal-fired plants, which also consume a lot of water. Their arable land is really under threat from a drought that's impacting their breadbasket. And the Beijing really wants to keep the impact away from individual homes, so they're turning off power to Tesla, to Apple, to Toyota, and that's just in the last 10 days. This, of course, is at a time when they're really ramping up for U.S. holiday Christmas season demand, and so this could be a real problem for supply chains.
We've all learned a lot about how big of a farm exporter the Ukraine is, and how much, you know, how big they really are in the global agricultural business. But how, talk to us about the North China Plain. How big is that?
Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, their production of corn and wheat is tremendous. Their production is about on par of wheat, about on par with Russia, and their corn is three times the production coming out of the Ukraine. So if they have a big drought, Argentina had a big one just 6 months ago, it impacted their corn production by 33%. If China has anything like that, they're going to be in the global markets buying a tremendous amount of corn and wheat. Those shortcomings, some analysis has shown, could mean they could be out there looking to purchase 20% of the corn that's traded worldwide and 13% of the wheat. Imagine the impact on North Africa, the rest of Africa, and the Middle East, which is already suffering from shortages of grain and the impact on hunger and food prices around the world. It's really quite frightening.
You know, we talk about, I think about years ago when ESG first got, you know, was up and running and people started talking about it, money flowing into it, David. You know, we talked about the material impact, financial material impact on companies as a result of climate change and the environment. You know, we're not just talking about material impact. We're talking about, you know, existence. I mean, things we all take for granted globally, food, water, if you will. These things are really threatened.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people talked about rare earths about 10 years ago and how China was really cornering the world market on rare earths. Rare earths are not that rare. They're ubiquitous, but China's the only country that's had the willingness to take the environmental hit to mine aggressively rare earths. Do you know what mining rare earths takes a lot of?
Water.
Tremendous amount of water to rinse those ores and concentrate those rare earths. That goes into everything. Chips, microphones, speakers, displays of every sort. China is the world's source of something like 80 or 90% of many of these rare earths. Now, if they're running low on water, they're certainly not going to be producing those rare earths for export, and that could really be a supply chain disruption.
I am trying to make sense. There's delistings, there's regulatory. You're talking about the water catastrophe. Let's just stick with the water story. How do you think this ultimately plays out longer term?
Well, I think China is going to have to be much more efficient with their use of water. 65% of their water consumption is industrial consumption. So then on top of that is agriculture, and on top of that is residential. So clearly China has long been the inexpensive workshop of the world, being able to mobilize very large workforces very efficiently and effectively to build companies like Foxconn and so on that can be very responsive to developed world needs. Given the aging population, given the pressures on their environment, including water, I think that's something the world can't count on in the next 10 years the same way they did in the last 10 years. So I worry about them exporting inflation the same way that they may have exported deflation in recent years. They can't make more water. You can print more money, you can't print more water. So they really need to be careful with the resource that they have. I think they're going to have to dial back usage.
You know, David, with all the challenges that investing in China has been presented with over the last couple of years, I'm talking regulatory challenges, COVID and their response to COVID, their policies there, now some of these resource issues that you're highlighting, I have to ask the question of every EM investor that I talk to, is China even investable?
China cannot be ignored from an investment point of view. Second largest economy in the world, largest, fastest growing a consumer market in the world, really the tail that wags the dog in terms of demand for commodities and all kinds of things. But I think smart investors are trying to find other unique ways to play it. Perhaps there are domestically listed plays that cover unique aspects of water treatment and water supply and so on and so forth that provide an opportunity to benefit from the changes in the water landscape. Maybe there's regional players or other countries around the world that benefit from China's current challenges. We've been talking to our clients a lot about Mexico. as an alternative for supply chains if China's under pressure.
A big thank you to David Riedel, president and founder of Riedel Research Group.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, YouTube's effective yet uneven formula for fighting extremism. This is Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Veterans, whatever you're going through, don't wait. Reach out. Find resources at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach. Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
For years, everyone was welcome on YouTube, no matter how extreme their views. But as the social giant became one of the most visited sites on the internet, the company has consistently struggled to adjust.
And some staff say they kept a double standard when it came to moderating extremism on the platform.
It's interesting. I feel like we've heard this before with social media platforms in general. Well, this is the subject, though, of Mark Bergen of Bloomberg, his upcoming book, the title, Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination.
An excerpt of the book is featured in this week's edition of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Mark and Businessweek editor Joel Weber spoke with me and Bloomberg senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld. Joel started by asking why YouTube has worked to combat extremism, but not all types of extremism.
It does get at this like very fascinating dilemma. It's not just YouTube has dealt with it, I think, more than any other company, just given its size. But it's something that's affected all major internet platforms. And partly, I think there's a couple different reasons. One is just the nature of the way the governments work, as that there's been a lot more in Western governments pressure and willingness to sort of tackle violent Islamist extremism. And you saw, like, there are sort of tech collaborations set in mind. There are lists of, like, known terrorists that YouTube uses, and they can ban these certain figures. YouTube is a gigantic digital advertising. It's very responsive to its advertisers. Part of the book's opening scene is June in 2017, when they're in the middle of this major boycott over videos, some of which were like ISIS allies that, you know, household brands were sponsoring. And these advertisers put pressure on YouTube and kind of forced them to act in a way that they hadn't before. And then once they were able to kind of clean up the system to make it amenable to these ads weren't sponsoring videos that marketers wanted, there was less pressure for them. So I think there's a combination where it was sort of very easy politically. Addressing white nationalism is a more complicated, especially in like U.S. contemporary politics, problem to thread. And there was less pressure from regulators and advertisers at the time.
How do people and machines do this? There's a passage from your book and indeed from this excerpt in the magazine that includes the phrase, use your judgment when talking content moderation. That's not necessarily a prescript rule, right?
Yeah, I thought that was, YouTube was really, it's hard for us to appreciate, but this was in 2006, starting 2005, 2006, is when I think they ran like some of their first sort of policy frameworks. And this was really before content moderation existed at the size of the internet, and YouTube had a problem that Facebook and other sort of text-based sites didn't have, which is they have video and they have moving images and they have like complications and all that brings. And so this was a team that was pretty scrappy and sort of inventing this on the fly. Like a lot of them were pretty well versed in the like weird dark recesses of the internet. And so use your judgment there were at the time a lot more of a like human sort of, you can call it editorial perspective and judgment about where the lines were drawn. And this was, they sort of viewed YouTube as this was a community of users and video broadcasters. And they sort of wanted videos that fit within the boundaries of that community. You know, fast forward a few years, they become this global platform, and moderation is this very complicated process. So it's a complicated process where the company increasingly wants to rely on machine learning systems as much as possible, in part because machine learning systems can just process so much video better, faster than humans. They're impartial and they're less, you know, the like Google cannot be accused of bias, or if they can point and say, like, listen, we have a policy rulebook and we have machine systems. We don't have humans with biases making these decisions.
One of the things that YouTube often says is that dealing with the threat of like Islamist extremism on the platform proved easier because, you know, multiple governments agree on those standards, right? Whereas with white That's right. nationalism, there isn't that same unanimity. So I'm wondering where does that leave things? Because it means that there's more reliance on AI and the code. You know, ultimately the code is what runs everything here. Where does that really leave things as you know, society continues to have these massive flare-ups?
Yeah, I think that they've made some significant changes, and partially because of some tragedies that they witnessed. The Christchurch shooting we talked about in the story, even the most recently Buffalo shooting. Like every time there's an incident like this, that is like often sometimes these events are like live stream on YouTube. Yeah. So they have taken action because of like pressure from their employee base and from politicians and from some of these big moments.
That was Bloomberg technology reporter Mark Berg in his book, Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. It hit shelves on September 6th.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Companies, really the world at large, you, me, Tim, everybody, continue to send more and more data into the cloud. That's been great for one service provider. We're talking about NetApp.
The company recently reported earnings and sales that beat Wall Street estimates. That is, the storage and data management company saw continued demand across segments that defied supply chain and currency challenges.
NetApp's CEO George Kurian joined me and Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney to talk about the latest quarter, as well as look ahead at what's next for the company.
We are excited. We're off to a great start to our new fiscal year. We just completed the first fiscal quarter of the year and saw broad-based demand and strength across all our geographies. We have set record highs pretty much across the board in terms of revenue, billings, gross margin dollars, operating margin dollars, and EPS for Q1. So I'm really pleased. It's always good to get off to a good start in the year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way, better than the alternative. Paul did break down some of your numbers. Your customer base has included the likes of Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, Hitachi, Intel, Tata. It's global in nature. It really gives us a good clue in terms of what's going on in the economy. How would you describe, in terms of more color, demand for your core products from your big customers?
We're involved in helping our customers store, protect, and use their data for business advantage. We do that not only with data center equipment for their data centers, but as you mentioned, with cloud-based services that are deeply integrated into the world's leading cloud providers, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, IBM, and others. And we saw a really good portfolio balance across all of our geographies and customer segments. Data, as you know, is foundational to competitive advantage, understanding customers, working with your supply chain, and so on. And so we continue to see demand strong, and we've had to work really hard to have all the supply to meet it. And we continue to do that work.
Talk to us about the supply chain. It's been such an issue for so many businesses across so many parts of the economy, and it's a global issue here. How is it for your company now versus maybe, you know, a year or two ago, and kind of how do you think it's going to progress?
I think a year ago was the really difficult time. We've seen kind of steady improvements in silicon availability, and I would say cautiously that we've seen stabilization in terms of, you know, the silicon supply chain. It's still not where it is needed to be to meet all of our demand, but at least it's stopped backsliding. We have also been doing work to deal with some of the freight and logistical challenges. I think as, you know, the sort of the gap between demand and supply continues to get a little bit smaller, with demand still ahead of supply, we hope that these things get better over the course of our next 12 months.
Well, I do wonder too, George, how did supply chain issues or pressures or constraints impact your ability to, you know, in terms of your adjustments or your outlook, or raising your outlook estimates for the full year?
You know, I think we have had to do a huge amount of work to be able to meet demand. We've had to re-engineer products. We've had to source supply in multiple parts of the world and sort of extraordinary measures to meet demand. I would say that backlog is still ahead of pre-pandemic levels. So we're still in elevated sort of backlog situations, and we'd love to be able to, you know, sort of make those products available to customers. We're working closely with our suppliers to do that. We did, in our press release, reconfirm the full year guidance, which, given the currency movement subsequent to when we guided, is actually taking up guidance, as you noted, by about a, you know, 1 or 2 points. So we feel good about, you know, demand. We feel that we've got to go do the work in supply and continue to do the work to meet it.
So, George, I love, from your perspective, where is the biggest source of growth for your business here over the next 5 years? I'm going to ask you to think a little bit far out, which I know your board asks you to do occasionally, but on a five-year plan, you're in so many pieces of the pie that are, you know, have some really strong growth dynamics. Where do you really think your focus should be?
We really see the two big transformational trends are data-driven business or digital business and cloud. You know, we, on the data side, we help our clients store, aggregate enormous amounts of data, whether it's for traditional applications like an ERP, or you mentioned Salesforce, those kinds of applications, or for the really modern advanced analytics and artificial intelligence applications. We, for example, work with companies like Siemens Healthineers, which makes medical imaging systems, and we use AI technology together with huge amounts of data to be able to make the life of a radiologist much easier. We can predict, help them predict which patients are more likely to have COVID or find cost-effective ways to deal with breast cancer and so on. So that's one, data, and the other is cloud. You know, you see there's a vast migration of customers to using cloud-based technologies, and we help all of the leading cloud providers as well as their end customers to make their cloud projects much more reliable, performant, secure, especially security of data from attacks like ransomware is a growing trend that we have really good solutions for.
Carol, I think I'm even in the cloud.
I know I am.
You know, if I'm in the cloud, you know, it's a thing. It's a market. So, George, I'm looking at our PGEO function on the Bloomberg terminal that allows me to look at breakdown of your businesses by lots of different measures. And by geography, I see that, you know, about a little more than half of your business is in the U.S. and Canada and Latin America, maybe about a third, 30% in Europe, and about 14% in Asia. How, going forward, where regionally will you be allocating more of your capital? Where do you see more growth on a regional basis?
We continue to focus on the biggest markets in each of those geographies. I think several years ago, about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we decided to participate in the China market, which is the largest Asian market, through a joint venture with Lenovo that allows us to serve the vast expanse of Chinese customers with local partnerships and local knowledge of the local market. So the rest of the world we serve through our own, you know, kind of sales and go-to-market organization and through partners. And we're pleased with the strength of our, you know, it's a balanced book of business. We've seen strong adoption of our portfolio across all the leading markets. And so I'm excited about what the future holds.
Hey, George, I do wonder, too, in some of the major macro issues that are out there, whether it's nearshoring, offshoring, onshoring, and then throw on top of that geopolitical tensions, which is creating all of that changes. How is that impacting you guys in terms of where you produce, where you do business?
Clearly, it's a great question, Carol. I think clearly over the last few years, both because of geopolitical risk, but also just supply availability and risk management, we've built a diverse kind of geographic base for supply and manufacturing. We've moved our dependence from the Far East to much more local markets. So we manufacture heavily in Mexico and in some parts of Europe. We've moved, you know, our supply base from a silicon perspective into a diverse mix of silicon providers. And we've moved the way our systems are built rather than from highly integrated systems that have risk from one component. We're moving it to more of a Lego style building block model so that if one component isn't there, you can slot in another one. So we've had to do a lot of work. We continue to believe that the world's, you know, we need to think about supply rather than in the old model of just-in-time management to actually de-risking supply to meet demand.
Yeah, that's, we've heard that from a lot of companies, a lot of different industries. Labor, you have about 12,000 employees. How tough is it to get labor? How tough is it to keep labor?
I think it's a very competitive job market, especially for the type of talent, software and cloud talent that we look for. We've got a really good value proposition for employees. They get to do great work in a, you know, very supportive culture, and we are got a global population, so we can source talent wherever in the world it is. Having the best talent in the world is a source of competitive advantage, and we've got good compensation programs to meet what's needed.
That was NetApp CEO George Kurian along with Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, more voices from the C-suite. The CFO of the electronics manufacturer Flex on the global economy and manufacturing and managing supply chains for a host of household names.
Yeah, exactly. Their customer list. I mean, you're going to know all of these companies so well. Plus, the CEO of OpenTable on why getting a dinner reservation feels more difficult than ever.
Now, going out to that meal is very much a planned event. Before, we had a lot of walk-ins for our restaurants. People are now booking 2 or 3 days in advance. We used to think that bar seating was the most unattractive seat at a restaurant. We're seeing bar seating increase twofold because you want to be in the fray. You want to be around people. And I think people are going to continue to crave going out.
And gender equality in America. We'll check out UBS's Own Your Worth report on female wealth empowerment.
Plus, Formidable, American women in the fight for equality. Historian Betsy Griffith shares lessons from the past.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day.
Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the CFO of Flex. It's a global manufacturing company working in defense, health, energy, housing, and more. Man, they have a cross-section of the global economy. We're going to get his take on macro conditions. I love talking to this guy.
Yeah, it's not just like a cross-section of the global economy. It's, you know, different types of industries and then also just different regions of the world. Really incredible company to talk to.
And play into the supply chains, yeah. Right? So much.
Yeah, really good conversation coming up. Another good conversation with historian Betsy Griffith. She discusses her new book, described by her former classmate Hillary Clinton as, quote, an essential history of the struggle by both black and white women to achieve their equal rights.
First up this hour, as the world reopens and individuals shift from buying stuff to doing things such as eating out or travel, that too can create another supply-demand imbalance.
For clarity on that, we checked in with Debbie Sue, the CEO of the online restaurant reservation company OpenTable, also a subsidiary of the publicly traded Booking Holdings.
She's got great insight into what's going on in the restaurant industry because her company gathers lots of data on who's booking what and when.
She spoke with me and Bloomberg senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld.
The restaurant industry has definitely seen a pickup in demand, and we're still seeing that kind of post-pandemic pent-up demand where a lot of us have been cooped up in our houses or our apartments. And there's this need to engage and meet with people and oftentimes over a meal. And so I think we're still seeing pent-up demand and people going out. So that demand has really held steady, even in places in like New York, where Goldman has requested everyone come back into the office. So New York is one of those cities where, versus a city like San Francisco, for example, people are coming back. You're seeing those lunchtime shifts starting to fill up. And so the city is definitely feeling more alive. And certainly it is very difficult to get a reservation on a Friday night. You're also seeing in New York tourist activity and travel activity really coming back in a way that we haven't seen in the last 2 years. So all really encouraging signs for Manhattan.
I swear, I actually got an IB during this program asking me to grab lunch in the fall from a listener and a source. So I guess the business lunch.
Are you going
to go? Yeah, I'm going to go. Of course I'm going to go.
That's what you call a flex, you know, making a reservation.
I mean, I'm not making the reservation. Someone else can. But in any case, Debbie, I am interested to situate this conversation in the broader economic landscape that we're living in, because all we talk about all day, and of course, this is on Bloomberg, so of course we would be talking about it, but we talk about inflation. We talk about recession fears. And you are seeing this pent-up demand, like you say, but how resilient do you think that is in the face of some of those big issues that we talk about?
As you mentioned, we're certainly in a challenging macro environment. And I think we're in unprecedented times here, because we've not had a recession that's followed, you know, with a 2 year essential pandemic. And so we're seeing that demand continue to hold. And I think even once people stop revenge eating, is what we like to call it here at Open Table, with the shape of work and return to work and what that whole thing, I think the future of work, or how work is different post-pandemic. I don't know if we're ever going to get back to a world of how it was before the pandemic. So we have a lot of people who work from home or have a hybrid situation, where now going out to that meal is very much a planned event. Like it's a bigger deal. And we're seeing that in shifts of behavior. Before, we had a lot of walk-ins for our restaurants. We're seeing a channel shift for that, you know, just regular casual walk-in. No, people are now booking 2 or 3 days in advance. Hence, you know, the comment earlier about being impossible to find a reservation. It's because everyone's booking. Everyone's looking forward to that restaurant at a meal. We used to think that bar seating was the most unattractive seat at a restaurant. We're seeing bar seating go across like a increase twofold, because those are now very, very desirable seats to sit at a restaurant, because you want to be in the fray, you want to be around people. And so I think it'll be really hard to tell what's going to happen in this macro environment. But I remain very bullish on dining. And I think people are going to continue to crave going out, and they will save pockets of, you know, their discretionary income for that event.
Hey, Debbie, before we let you go, I want to get an update on the Open Table business and how you're competing with other platforms like Resy, for example. Give us an update there.
We love competition here at Open Table. I think it pushes us to be faster and more innovative. We are slugging it out with them and other players all the time. At Open Table, we really believe that we are a true partner for our restaurants. We stand by our product. We've continued to iterate during the pandemic and post the pandemic, making sure that we give restaurants all of the tools they need to be running their businesses productively, efficiently, effectively, especially given this macro environment. We've launched features like direct messaging, where now, you know, hosts don't have to just be on their phones SMSing and confirming or calling. You can do that directly through Open Table's products. So we're really looking at all the different ways that we can make from the diner's point of view and from the restaurant's point of view, a more seamless dining experience. It's tough times our industry has gone through some stuff in the last few years. The best thing you can do to support restaurants is to show up. No-shows continue to be, have always been a problem, but especially post-pandemic.
Yes, please cancel your reservations if you know you're not going to. I mean, we had to cancel a reservation recently and it was $50.
Oh my gosh.
Cancel a dinner reservation.
Are you kidding?
No.
Oh.
But we got around it by rescheduling for like a few months from now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
That way, though, it is a lot easier on the rest of us and, of course, the restaurants as well.
Be considerate, everybody. Cancel if you're not going.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time.
It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Flex, it's a publicly held global manufacturer and supply chain solutions company. It serves many industries with customers ranging from Apple and Cisco Systems to Ford and so many more, Tim.
Yeah, needless to say, they've got a great sense of macro themes that we talk about every day on our program. Paul Lundstrom is the company's CFO. He gave us a bird's eye view, starting with the strengths and weaknesses across different global industries.
Just to kind of walk you through the portfolio, we just had an earnings call a month ago, and one of the things that we talked about was a little bit of softening in some of the shorter cycle consumer product markets. But for us, that is much more than offset by, you know, we continue to see very robust demand in a number of other areas. Things like networking and connectivity, whether it's, you know, cloud or 5G, that continues to be very, very strong. Network security continues to be very, very strong. A number of the industrial markets, including things like renewable energy, that probably seems obvious, but that continues to see robust growth. We're quite pleased with what we've seen there. Even things like automotive, which is, you know, you'd expect demand to soften if the economy softens it up here in the automotive space. But frankly, there's so much backlog, and that whole sector is going through so much restocking.
So what is it holding up those products? I mean, we talk about chips all the time, but really dig into that for us. Like, where are you seeing in the supply chain the bottlenecks right now?
Well, certainly it's chips, to just give you sort of the short, brief answer. Semiconductors has been a big bottleneck, but so have things like overseas logistics. You know, ports stacking up with container ship after container ship. Who hasn't seen aerial photographs of that? But, you know, from my standpoint, you look to the root cause. Going into the pandemic, the world economy was already doing pretty well. And so in a lot of cases, producers were just barely keeping up with demand. Now you sprinkle in COVID, you see production, you know, shut down for months on end in a lot of different geographies. While at the same time you have, and this isn't just a US thing, this is, you know, world governments just pounded stimulus spending, pounded it. And so what that did was, you know, I think demand did not go down like many thought it would. In some cases, demand actually went up. But then when you take away the ability for producers to produce, the backlog just went through the roof, and we've been trying to recover ever since.
You mentioned some regional differences, and that's really where I want to dig into right now, is get an understand from you about where we're seeing some economic softness. And I know, look, we can talk about what we've seen from Europe over the last few months and some softness there and concerns about recession there, but where are some regions with strength and where are some regions with weakness?
Yeah, I would say I see less region to region and more product to product. And so, you know, from my vantage point, the shorter cycle consumer product markets.
What is the shorter cycle consumer product?
Think of it as more commoditized electronics, you know, cell phones and laptops and that sort of stuff. And that over the last, you know, quarter or two, we have seen that soften up a little bit. It probably will, you know, continue that way as you look forward. But I would say that's worldwide. You know, that's not unique to one particular region. Where we continue to see robust demand is the more infrastructure-related technology. You know, things like 5G and cloud continues to be, you know, very, very robust.
But are there areas of the world that are sticking out to you where you're seeing weakness?
Well, the zero COVID policy in China is, that's not going to help those local markets. I think people want to get back to work and get back to normal. And so, you know, we see it more from a supply chain perspective than from a specific end market perspective. But yeah, that would be an example where it would be nice to get back to a little bit of normalcy.
Can you talk a little bit about how you've navigated China's zero COVID policy, Paul?
Scale really does matter. You know, we have a very wide geographic reach. And so we also have a very large supplier network. And so as things have been, you know, coming on and offline in China over the last couple of years, frankly, it's been a little easier for us to pivot. You know, I think we can produce like for like, you know, from one region to the next without a whole lot of notice. And because we have a large supply chain network, it helps. So I think scale has been a big, you know, help for a company like ours.
I'm wondering about globalization and where we are in 2022. Before we went into the pandemic, we saw a move, at least from the United States, of trying to isolate China to a certain extent under the Trump administration's tariffs and policies. And during the pandemic, we saw just how fragile so many of the global supply chains were. So now we're hearing from companies where they're onshoring or reshoring or nearshoring, you know, use the shoring word that you want to use, but they're moving production to other parts of the world. What are the themes that you're seeing?
Well, yeah, first of all, you just nailed it. I mean, going back to the globalization and labor arbitrage that, you know, and not just US, China, I mean, go back 10, 20, 30 years ago, you know, it's been about labor arbitrage for decades now. And Western companies have made the decision to produce in the Far East for you know, a long, long time. Because of all the issues that we've seen over the last few years, and you're right, you know, it started with trade politics. And I would say it's been, you know, across multiple administrations now where that tone and rhetoric really hasn't improved. Then you have COVID, then you have chip shortages, then you have logistics. It's been shock after shock after shock. And so what we're seeing now is this trend where customers are coming to us and saying, we don't want to produce everything. We don't want to be captive to Asia anymore. We want to produce in Asia for Asia. But if you can, we'd like you to produce in Europe for Europe, in North America for North America, because we're worried about our supply chain resilience.
How tough is it to get employees around the world right now?
Look, unemployment is low, and it's not just the U.S. You know, we're seeing it all over the place. You know, where there's labor shortages in Malaysia, there's labor shortages in China, there's labor shortages all over the place, and so that definitely puts some pressure on the system, and we'll probably have some upward pressure on wages here for a little bit.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go, sort of this idea of inflation and to what extent you see inflation sticking around. What is your own, as CFO of Flex, what is your own outlook on inflation? What are you planning for?
Well, we're planning for higher, for sure. And, you know, we do everything we can to insulate the business from that. And you know, our probably quickest, most readily usable lever is price, and passing the cost inflation on our side through to the end customer. That's not great for overall inflation. And look, I'm not going to make a call on where we're going to be. I do like that the Fed is being more aggressive and trying to get this in check, but it could be around for a little while.
That's Paul Lundstrom, CFO of Flex. A lot of really great insights in that interview, but I got to say, I feel like he's the 100th executive who's told us that high prices, Carol, are here to stay.
Nothing transitory, right?
No.
No.
Yeah. You're not even allowed to say that word anymore.
I know. Gosh, sorry about that. All right. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, women taking control of their wealth and society learning from the past when it comes to gender equality.
We lean in big when it comes to women empowerment. Stick around. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
On August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment was formally adopted into the Constitution. Congress celebrates this date every year with Women's Equality Day. We often talk about how the U.S., though, is still far from equal on many levels, men versus women, white women versus black women. Bloomberg recently reported that women still earn about 73 cents for every $1 that men make, that according to data from ADP Research Institute.
This next half hour, back-to-back interviews on women's social and financial equality. And on that, a UBS survey found that 78% of women say they expect to outlive their spouses, but more than half of women, that's 54%, say that their spouses take the lead when it comes to major financial decisions.
That's a pretty big disconnect. All right, here with more is Carrie Schuffman, head of the Women's Strategic Segment at UBS Global Wealth Management, speaking with Tim and Katie Greifeld.
The reality is that women do tend to, on average, have longer life expectancies than their male counterparts, on average by about 5 years, and that is the reality that we tend to see. I think about my own grandmother, who for whom we just celebrated her 90th birthday earlier this year, and she's been widowed for over 5 years already and has been on her own. And that's really, I think, part of the reason why and the catalyst behind a lot of the research that we've done here at UBS focused on women and financial well-being and helping to ensure that women from all different walks of life and financial situations, ages, generations are prepared to navigate their financial journey.
Yeah, what's remarkable to me about this research that you did at UBS is that The U.S. is kind of in the middle when it comes to women deferring long-term financial decisions to their spouses. On one end, you have women in Singapore who 72% mm-hmm. say that my spouse takes the lead. The other end of the spectrum, 39% in Mexico. So, you know, it's not just a problem here in the U.S., it's a problem globally. But how do you explain the regional differences or regional variations here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it depends on many different factors. I think it depends on demographics, culture, how families are structured as well. Certainly that applies here as well. I would say in the United States in particular, which is where my team and I focus our efforts, you know, you also have to really take into account the historical context around the topic of women and money. And this certainly varies by geographies as well. But you think back to something like, it wasn't until 1974 that the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was passed, which gave women the ability to apply for credit, a credit card, mortgage, et cetera, without having to have a male cosigner. I mean, 1974 was not that long ago. So there were a lot of barriers, I would say, and things that made it more difficult for women to gain equal financial footing until relatively recently. And certainly that, I think, plays a role in all of this as well.
Well, let's talk about partnership here, because according to your research, you write that women who approach long-term decisions in partnership with their spouses report soaring levels of satisfaction. So how do people go about doing this? I mean, I do think that oftentimes in partnerships like these, there is one person who handles, you know, certain tasks and another person handles other tasks, and it's kind of divided between the two.
Absolutely. And I think that's human nature, right? You know, if you are in a marriage or partnership, we all have time constraints no matter who we are or where we are in our lives. We have to take a divide and conquer approach. Certain things take priority over others. But I will say that when it comes to long-term finances, it's critically important, whether you're single, whether you're married, whatever your marital status may be, that you have an active understanding of where you are in your financial life and sort of where you're heading, both for to be able to achieve your own goals, to weather any personal headwinds, but to also weather, you know, the more macro environment around you. Our research actually showed, and you alluded to this, that only one in five heterosexual married couples here in the U.S. actually share equally in the long-term financial decisions. And again, as you mentioned at the onset, about half of women tell us that they defer those long-term financial decisions to a partner or spouse. But I think it's a question of trying to make the time, trying to also overcome some of the confidence gaps that our research has uncovered. Surprisingly, 70% of the women with whom we spoke said that they believe that women on the whole tend to overestimate what's required to be financially engaged. So certainly trying to break down some of those barriers, so some of those misperceptions around what it takes to have those meaningful conversations about where you are and where you're headed financially. And the good thing and the benefit is that our research shows there's tremendous upside to being an active participant in those financial matters, particularly among couples, whether it's greater satisfaction in your financial situation, higher confidence in achieving your goals, and my personal favorite, less stress and less arguments.
That's Carrie Shuffman, head of the Women's Strategic Segment at UBS Global Wealth Management.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
A recent Bloomberg Business Week cover story spoke about American women at the breaking point, noting how the undoing of Roe v. Wade made everything far more precarious. Our next guest has written extensively about the advancement of women and struggles they faced along the way.
She graduated from Wellesley College in the same class as former U.S. Secretary of State and former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Her biography of Elizabeth Cady Stanton inspired a Ken Burns PBS documentary. And her new book chronicles the efforts of white and black women to advance sometimes competing causes.
We're talking about historian and author Betsy Griffith and her new book, Formidable, American Women in the Fight for Equality, 1920 to 2020. Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney joined me for this interview, and we began by asking Betsy about her approach for the book.
I started with the question of what happened after women won the vote and were added to the U.S. Constitution on August 26th. 1920, 102 years ago today. What happened next? Journalists would say a decade later that the 19th Amendment promised almost everything and accomplished almost nothing. They made a huge stride to break into voting, but then white women rarely voted and black women were barred from voting by discrimination at the state level in voting laws. So these women had more to do. White women would pursue running for office and legislative agendas and a sundry list of causes. Black women had an even broader agenda. They wanted to safeguard Black Americans. They wanted to end lynching, end discrimination, and try some ways to secure equal rights. But it was so dangerous for them to behave in any public active manner that many of them acted behind the scenes very quietly out of church basements as deacons or agricultural agents. So it is a complicated story in American history, but I think we need to accept that our history is complicated and learn as much about it as we can. Women have made enormous gains since 1920, but we haven't come anywhere near far enough. Just speaking in terms of economics, the jobs that the majority of women hold are in the lowest part of the employment sector. The jobs, there are 98% of kindergarten teachers are women, 76% of public school teachers, we're only 38% of lawyers. We think we've made a lot of gains because women are so much more visible, and many women have succeeded enormously. But until a lot of women, more women, have that access, that agency, that privilege, we aren't anywhere near there. So the fight is not done, and we're facing some setbacks now. The reference you made to the whole reproductive rights issue, women who can make decisions about when to have babies, how many babies, the age of they are when they have babies, then can make decisions about education, about their employment. And one of the reasons women succeeded as rapidly as they did in the last 50 years was because they had reliable birth control and constitutional right to end a pregnancy if they needed to. There are so many issues that contribute to the equal rights of Black and white women, and they still need to be addressed.
Give us an anecdote from your book that really summarizes kind of the struggle in the early years.
It is hard for women today to imagine not having any rights, not having, in the 1920s, not having the right to own property, in some states not keeping their wages. Women did not serve on juries just because they got the right to vote. They didn't have a right to divorce widely or child custody, access to very few jobs, access to limited education, still in the 1920s. It seems incomprehensible to women today that women could have been so powerless.
The book is, you know, just a real narrative analysis of the decades-long women's fight for equality. Based upon all your research you did for this book, based upon everything you learned from this book, again, over a 100-year period, where do you think the women's movement needs to go from here?
I think they need to recharge. The fight to get suffrage was more than 100 years, and it was called the Long, Hard Fight. We made an enormous amount of progress beginning in the 1960s, in part related to reproductive rights, the availability of the pill, the Roe decision, but enough other things changed. Legislative change, Title VII, the Equal Credit Act, Title IX, many positive things were propelling women forward. But then there came a huge pushback from conservative women. Women are not all one thing. There's enormous diversity, racial, economic, educational, age, all those things that divide us. And there are certainly women and men who oppose the goals of the women's movement. And I think that we maybe have been riding on our success for a while and not expecting the pushback that we've been getting in voting rights and reproductive rights. Women are still, women need accessible, affordable childcare. They need paid family leave. Those two pieces of legislation alone would have enormous impact on women's economic well-being, their participation in the workforce. So there's more to do. And I think we need to think more broadly about women's issues. Since the 60s, we've been saying every issue is a women's issue. But I'm not sure that feminists would have included food deserts or the quality of education in poorer regions of this country or what happens in medical care. We're still seeing too much maternal and infant death and discrepancies in those treatments. We need to get back in the fight, and not just in the streets. We need to be lobbying, going door to door, electing people to the legislature who support those goals. I think we're in a real period of challenge, and it will take a long time to win again, unless there are just something dramatic happens in the two upcoming elections.
All right. So our Nancy Lyons, who covers world and national news out of DC, is shooting us a message, and she says, you've got to ask Betsy about blue and pink timelines and how you divide history for women along the pink timeline, and something that we probably all don't know about. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Sure. Not much women's history was written before the 1970s, and it got written because the government got rid of the graduate student deferment, and so graduate schools emptied of men who went to the war, and women filled those seats. And when women are doing graduate work in history, like every other category of person who's done graduate work, you tend to study your own field. So women wrote about women. And they began to create some methodology about women. And one was to think about timelines. We have all learned the American history timeline, from the colonial period to the federal period to the Constitution to the antebellum America to the Reconstruction, industrialization, immigration, the 20s, the 30s. That's our timeline. And it's dominated, not unsurprisingly, by presidents and generals and economic leaders. And that's what we all learned. And I believe most textbooks today are still divided in that way. The 19th Amendment doubled the size of the voting population and enfranchised 26 million women. And you rarely get a chapter devoted to suffrage, and you always get a chapter about Jacksonian democracy. So the blue timeline marks events on your standard American timeline. A pink timeline suggests that all those blue events impacted women's lives, but there were other events, mm-hmm. for example, the invention of the baby bottle nursing nipple, or the tin can, or the sewing machine, or the refrigerator, that made women's lives enormously better. That wars, many wars on the blue timeline, affecting men and women differently. Wars are devastating for everybody, men and women, but they are opportunities of great economic advancement for women. They get to go into jobs that were forbidden to them. Mm-hmm. In the Civil War, they become secretaries. In the First World War, short war, but they got to be elevator operators and bus drivers. And of course, all those Rosie the Riveters filling up the factories during the Second World War.
Right.
You know very well that the women's participation in the American workforce has not declined since 1947.
That was historian and author Betsy Griffith. Her new book is called Formidable: American Women and the Fight for Equality, 1920 to 2020. She joined Carol along with Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney.
We're going to have her back because I know you would love her. I mean, I feel like I could sit and talk to her for hours because of what she has seen, written about, and just a different perspective.
And I wonder if there's going to be another Ken Burns documentary based on this book.
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see on that. And we just want to say our thanks to Paul Sweeney and Bloomberg senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld for joining us over the past week or so for a bunch of our interviews. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week. It airs Monday through Friday, starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Happy Labor Day, everyone. This is Bloomberg.
Hey guys, it's me, Isabella Gomez, filling in for Smokey Bear because he's got more to say than just...
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Like, if you're outside enjoying a barbecue, don't let a hamburger distract you from fire safety. Make sure you aren't dumping your hot coals or ashes onto the ground because that could start a wildfire. So take wildfire prevention seriously and let's save the world one day at a time. Juntos con Smokey Bear, podemos hacerlo. Go to SmokeyBear.com to learn more about wildfire prevention.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th,
1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.